start with Curran versus United States.
May it please the Court, Mark Stern for the United States. The district court in this case correctly recognized for the most part the proper analysis of the actions of the intelligence analysts whose negligence resulted in the plaintiff's very regrettable imprisonment. District court recognized the FTCA, the Federal Tort Claims Act, generally bars actions for false arrest, and the act also contains an exception to the exception when for actions taken by law enforcement officers and investigative officers, a term that's defined in the act, and it's a proviso that was put into the statute essentially to deal with the kinds of abuses that were occurring by people who would enter no-knock raids and then, you know, proceed to assault people. And that background is discussed at some length in this court's decision in Orsay, which is cited in our brief. Now, the intelligence analysts whose negligent question basically information that was phoned into them, and one of the four intelligence analysts made a mistake in the spelling of the plaintiff's name, which ultimately resulted in his indictment in Arizona grand jury. And the district court recognized that that kind of negligence would be barred as falling within an exception for the bar on actions for false arrest. The only place where the district court, having engaged in an altogether correct analysis, then we respectfully submit error, being that the plaintiff could nevertheless proceed on a claim of a grossly negligent police investigation. And the problem with that, even apart from some of its other difficulties, that, as this court has repeatedly recognized, it doesn't matter what label you put on to a claim if the damages that you're seeking are resulting from the false arrest, because the act talks about for damages arising under a claim.
Why aren't the analysts considered investigative officers, given that they had the power to do the administrative searches and were in fact engaged in searches and review of data?
Well, I mean, the act requires you to be able to seize, to make arrests or seize evidence.
Well, they did seize evidence,
well,
didn't they?
With respect, no, Your Honor, and the district court certainly didn't think that they had. I mean, plaintiff made the argument to the district court that he's making on appeal, which is that they were law enforcement officers for that reason, on the theory that they could issue administrative subpoenas. Now, first, that's wrong as a matter of fact.
But they gathered data from the telephone companies and from the DMV,
well,
and then matched the data. Is that wrong?
So they did. That's absolutely right, Your Honor. But that's not seizing evidence. I mean, there are a lot of people.
They're gathering evidence.
Well, but it's very different, Your Honor. I mean, there are a lot of people who work on the analysis of evidence.
I don't know how you can distinguish what they did from investigation and just say, well, it's a category of just analysis. I mean, it wasn't as though they were presented with this body of data, and then they analyzed it. They were out there gathering it, matching it, and producing things from it.
Well, but you have to be able to seize evidence. I mean, that's the line that's at issue. I mean, that's why it goes back to the people. I mean, what Congress had in mind when it passed the exception to the exception was the idea of people who have the authority to basically, I mean, the quintessential example are the ones that Congress discusses. It's people who come into your house, and while they're there, they act in bad faith and do, you know, and assault people. I mean, that's what Congress was specifically concerned with. Now, the We don't have to go to how limited that is. They're here. We're nowhere near where you would be for someone who can seize evidence. I mean, the only argument the plaintiff makes about that is that the analyst can issue administrative subpoenas. Now, first of all, the analysts can't issue administrative subpoenas. It's clear we cite the regulations. The very subpoena that's reproduced by the plaintiff does not have the analyst's signature. The analysts don't have the power even to issue an administrative subpoena. In turn, even if they could, an administrative subpoena is something that can only be enforced absent consent in an action by the Attorney General. It's all laid out in our reply brief. So that even just as a starter, that's just not accurate. But again, the point is that there are a lot of people whose actions can contribute to the issuance of a subpoena. What the exception is designed to do is not, Congress didn't want, intended to exclude actions for false arrest. Congress knew that there could be situations in which there would be a mistaken and unfortunate situation like this one, but it didn't. It generally barred them, and when it enacted the law enforcement proviso, it didn't say anybody who helps to analyze reports or helps to prepare reports for the police. It put in a limited exception which reflects the problem that Congress was trying to deal with, and there are no cases that of which we're aware or cited that remotely resemble anything like this one. And again, the argument that was made to the district court and was made on appeal, and the district court heard it and rejected it, was that the supposed authority to issue administrative subpoenas is what pushes the analysts over the line into being law enforcement officers, and that's incorrect. And the district court instead proceeded, the district court, had it stopped there, just would have been, incorrect, and instead the district court looked to this notion of there being an alternative ground of grossly, police negligent investigation. Again, it doesn't matter how you style your claim. That's what this court said in Arnsberg and in Snow Erlin and in Thomas Lazier. It's courts dealt with this kind of a claim many before, and this court is also in Arnsberg and Thomas Lazier expressly said that the law enforcement exception does not apply to the actions of people who provide the kinds of information that then goes to procure a false arrest. And that Arnsberg said it, the 11th Circuit then picks up an Arnsberg in its Metz decision, and back in Thomas Lazier, this court then in turn approvingly cites the Metz decision. And these were all decisions from the 80s. This has been sort of established for a long time now. And the district court's sort of circumvention of this at the end just is a mistake, and it's doubly a mistake because the tort on which it relies would be one that would only be, if it did exist, would only be applicable to state actors and not to private actors, which the Supreme Court decision in Olson makes clear it cannot be a basis for allowing a claim to go forward, and is sort of further problematic because, in fact, even the Arizona courts haven't actually ever held a municipality liable on those grounds. They've only suggested that they might recognize that, but just even assuming that they did recognize it in some case, it really doesn't matter because it couldn't be applied under Olson, and even more fundamentally, it would still just represent a way of circumventing the bar on false arrest actions. And plaintiff's claim is obviously a sympathetic one. That's, it's not the question. Congress, when it barred the false arrest actions, was doing it for actions that would be meritorious, not just for actions that would be vexatious. And we submit that this really just falls plainly within that bar.
The way the statute is laid out, if someone, if a federal person authorized to make arrest makes a false arrest, the person can sue the federal government. If a person unauthorized to make an arrest makes a false arrest, they can't.
I don't think that that's necessarily the case.
The way the act seems to explain it, first, you can't sue for false arrest generally.
Right.
So if somebody, some federal employee arrests somebody falsely, and it's somebody who works in the mint or something, you can't sue.
I mean, if someone arrests someone falsely, I mean, usually the actions for false arrest, like, rarely come up, like, when people are executing warrants. It's almost, if you're acting in bad, the way that it could come up is if you're executing a warrant and you know, and this was part of plaintiff's theory, that, like, people knew that, like, it was intentional. But if you're executing a warrant, you're a law enforcement officer, and you really know that what you're doing is wrong, you know, then it might be possible to have an action. But remember, the intentional torts exception, I mean, the proviso to it, was also designed to deal with questions with the other torts, you know, including assault. And I think that was really the particularly motivating one. But again, that's what most of the examples go to. But again, if you have the authority, or if you're a law enforcement officer and you just make an arrest in bad faith, you know, you pull somebody off the street.
Oh, I understand that.
That is an action you could bring. You're authorized to make an arrest. You make an arrest in bad faith. You meet all the criteria for a state law tort. That's someone whom you can sue. I mean, we're not saying that this.
It's just a very puzzling way to say you can't sue for false arrest unless the arrest is made by the kind of person who almost certainly would be making an arrest. But I think there's something in the briefs on another subject that said that the DEA authorizes it, that the animal actually be used to arrest the DEA. Is that?
Oh, no, Your Honor. I mean, we've set out the provisions and cited them all sort of in the reply brief in response to some of the plaintiff's arguments.
Maybe I'll ask opposing counsel about that.
Yeah, no, they're not. These are essentially people who are inputting data, and, you know, they're likely in, I mean, it's very much sort of a kind of a job. And they also make very clear that what they do is they have a special agent in charge. But again, what Your Honor's listening to is that, yes, some Congress had in mind when it put in this proviso was that the kind of people that should be making an arrest, a law enforcement, you know, officer, if somebody in fact comes in and arrests you and it really meets the criteria of a false arrest, absolutely. That's what Congress was trying to get at. You can sue the United States in a circumstance like that. What Congress didn't want to do was recognizing that there are just inevitably, like, and this is a, you know, this is a joint, this in some ways typifies the kind of problem that arises. I think there was something like 30,000, like, phone call names being put in here by a joint federal-state task force, and Congress were to balance, have struck a different balance, you would have to be taking into account the number of actions and damages and the impact on law enforcement that would result if the negligence of all of those kinds of employees could give rise to an action when it's here they result.
But we look to state law, and this seems to be kind of a unique state law cause of action, unique to Arizona, that the district court recognized.
But it doesn't. The problem is that it doesn't. Even if that cause of action existed, it would one just represent a. You can't get damages that result that are essentially sort of coterminous with those that are a false arrest, and which is what plaintiff is at all times claim. And again, it also couldn't work under United States versus Olson.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Good morning. Ann Findling with Robinson Curtin for Mr. Kearns. Let me begin by answering your question about the false arrest. Think of an individual who is not a law enforcement officer who is a federal employee effectuates an arrest that one might bring a Bivens claim. I'm not sure that's left without a remedy, perhaps a Bivens claim more appropriately than an FTCA claim. And that would be rather against the individual as opposed to the government. I think that might be the answer to that question. This case, though, you know, when the government says that this is an unfortunate situation, let's look at what Judge Wake in his very well-reasoned opinion said. He said this was gross negligence. He could not believe that given they had this information, that they didn't collate it and pass it on to the agents so that the correct person could be arrested. And the question now is there a remedy for this? The facts are given, gross negligence is given, and the question is, does Arizona law recognize a cause of action? What I'd like to do is suggest a three-step process for you that might cut through some of these questions. I think first, if you look for whether there's a remedy under Arizona law for this conduct, that if you begin with Olson and look at how Olson talks about like circumstances, not the same circumstances, but like circumstances. Like circumstances, let's look at a private party. What if MCI, not the analyst, but what if MCI had been grossly negligent in the transmission of identifying information? In this case, the good Scott, Mr. Kearns, who was not the target of the investigation, might well have a remedy against MCI. Because under Arizona law, and Arizona, we take our torts seriously. We've got a constitutional provision. We take our torts seriously. That, in fact, Mr. Kearns might well have had a cause of action had MCI made the very mistake that was made by this analyst. Now, what the government wants to say is, well, our analysts are sort of isolated, and they're not part of this process. So even though their defense at trial for false arrest was agents rely on agents, we have this analyst conduct out there that's been described as grossly negligent that somehow insulates both the arresting officer and the analyst. And I would suggest under Arizona law that's not the correct result. So again, looking at the general provision where the government has waived its immunity, would a private person be liable? And I think the answer is no doubt they would. Look at the Dedman case. If you take Olson together with Dedman, it clearly establishes that in Arizona, this type of conduct, again, similar circumstances, would lead to liability. So given that we have liability under the general provision, let's look at the two exceptions that the government raises in defense. Exception number one, this is a discretionary activity. This isn't discretionary. No federal agent has the discretion to ignore exculpatory evidence and not pass it along. There's nothing about that conduct that would make you want to protect it or say it's discretionary. If you told every agent they have to pass on exculpatory information, that's not going to bring law enforcement to a halt. So by virtue of the information that the analyst had, that needed to be, again, passed on, the agents then, when the agent took that information and used that information to arrest Mr. Kearns, that information, that grossly negligent information, it's not discretionary. There's no discretion involved in that. So given that there's no discretion, okay, that's the first exemption that the government talks about, right? Okay, the second exception is this law enforcement exception, which actually creates a really interesting policy question. And that is, okay, given that the officer is not liable because he relies on the analyst, and the analyst is not responsible because she's not law enforcement, does that leave no remedy? And I would suggest no, that's not what's intended by the statute.
Well, that's, of course, the common result in sovereign immunity. Somebody gets thrown out if
But see, here's the thing. In this case, the analyst's conduct is not the false arrest. The analyst's conduct is gross negligence. The false arrest aspect of the case, it's the agent saying, I relied on another agent, I can't be responsible for having a false arrest. Even though there was a false arrest in the factual context, she didn't make the arrest. She gave the information upon which the arrest was made, and she did so in a negligent manner, and not just a negligent manner, but a grossly negligent manner. So either she's part of the investigative process, in which case she comes within the exception, or she's not part of the investigative process, which means you should treat her like any other citizen, and that puts you back at Dedman. So...
Well, that it's hard to make that prong work, that alternative work, isn't it? Because your damages are totally arise out of a false arrest.
Well, his damages are. His damages certainly arise from the fact that he was taken from his home and he was transported and he got to spend some time in Sheriff Joe's jail, and that's not a pleasant experience. But the false arrest, it's the fact that her negligence led to the false arrest. She didn't do the arrest. Somebody else did the arrest.
I agree with that. But I guess the I have trouble reading the Tort Claims Act exceptions for false arrest other than as conditioning the whole scheme. In other words, it's hard for me just to say, well, you can take a state law analogy under the Tort Claims Act when false arrest is excluded. So it seems to me you have to get to your other alternative that you just put, that somehow they're really part of the whole law enforcement apparatus.
Which I think is what, I think that's what the correct result in the case is, that she's part of this investigatory process. It focuses on, you know, the exceptions focus on one of two things. One is the actual functions. That's the discretionary aspect. The other is the status. Are you a law enforcement officer? Well, she's part of that whole process. She's not outside someplace else. She's not disconnected from the process. As you suggested earlier, she's intimately involved in the investigative process. So when you look at the plain language of the statute, which says empowered by law to execute searches, to seize evidence, make arrests, they're talking about someone who is in the investigative process. And, in fact, these analysts were in the investigative process. Either that's got to be true or these agents can't rely on them. I mean, it doesn't make sense from a tort standpoint, you know, where are incentives, compensating individuals, to have this area of insulation of liability. Because what's the incentive there? Let's have all the analysts do all the work, and then the officer just shows up, makes the arrest, and there's never a consequence. And I don't think that's what the FTCA anticipates at all. And the reason I don't think that is because the FTCA wants us to look at the state law where these actions occurred. Again, looking at the Arizona law, Arizona has been open to inquiries about in this exact nature. Dedman is a great example. In Dedman, that information was all there, that teller could have shown that the individual who was trying to get an advance on his credit card was actually the person who owned the credit card. I mean, that was all within the bank's employees' ability. And the court said, you can hold Valley Bank liable. You can hold that employee liable because that information was right there and available. And I think, again, going back to what is it that the FTCA covers? The FTCA covers the torts that would apply to a private person, that private persona. It's not just in the exact same circumstances. You can analogize to other circumstances.
But counsel, doesn't the language of 2680H suggest that even if a plaintiff can identify another theory of liability under state law, such as negligence, that claim is barred if it's based on false arrest or one of the other torts that are listed in the statute?
But there was an arrest made, but The action isn't based on the false arrest because there's no false arrest available because the law enforcement individual relies on other agents. So that it's not really a false arrest case. I mean, although that is the conduct, that was the damage, it's not really a false arrest case. So it's a gross negligence case.
Are you arguing that it's not a false arrest case because you're not suing the officers who made the arrest?
Because the officers who actually made the arrest are not the people who are being held accountable here. Because remember, at the trial court, and in fact this was in the materials that were supplied in the excerpts from the record, that there was a specific discussion. What's the status of the evidence? The status of the evidence is agents rely on agents. And that's the way that the process works, so that one agent doesn't have to go do all the inquiry to check, cross-check another agent. They rely on one another, which is why that's why in this particular case it makes much more sense to find that the analyst is part of the investigative process, because then it's the collective information, and then it's then you have a false arrest from that information. But if you do separate the analyst out, then you look at that analyst's conduct in light of Arizona law. And there's Arizona law allowing for a gross negligence claim.
But negligence isn't a tort standing by itself. Negligence causes some sort of harm, and then it becomes a tort when it injures
right.
somebody.
And her negligence caused the officers to take possession of someone they should not have taken possession of. But again, that doesn't.
And what is the duty for the tort?
What's her duty?
You have to have a duty.
I would say the duty under Arizona law is when you undertake to acquire and disseminate information which may, upon its dissemination, have significant consequences to a third party, that you have a obligation or duty under Arizona law to do so non-negligently, Dedman. That in this case, though, it's not just negligence, it's gross negligence. Judge Wake actually found that it was gross negligence. So in terms of, you have a negligence, for example, just a car accident. It's a negligence action that results in a car wreck. It's called negligence. It's not negligently driving a car. It's a negligence action. And I think in this case, you have a similar situation. You have gross negligence, and it resulted, again, it did result in an arrest, but can stand on its own given the Arizona case law. Perhaps the better analytical result is that the analyst is part of the investigative process, because, again, you end up with this anomaly where you have people insulated from liability that don't seem under the FTCA to qualify for that. That behavior, to have that insulated and beyond review, doesn't jive with the FTCA. And yes, in these cases you get anomalies. But if you look at Olson, if you look at Indian Towing, the lighthouse case, you know, a private person, if you don't put the light out and people are expecting it and somebody gets hurt, you're liable. But then you look at Howard, and Howard looks to state law and says, if you are a recreational use landowner and you would be immune under the state law, then you're immune under the FTCA. And again, I think that advances what the FTCA policy would be.
Would you have had a Bivens action against the analysts considered separately?
No. I'm not sure that you would, because the question would be a constitutional question. Actually, I'm not sure I have the right answer to that. But no, I don't think it. Don't think it would be a Bivens. I think it would be a state law case.
Because they were.
I'm sorry.
I didn't hear. You think it would be what?
I think it's. Because it's a tort and would be covered under the FTCA, I think it would be under that. I guess the question is, should there have been an alternate pleading of a Bivens case? And not for the gross negligence. I think the Bivens is more of the false arrest case that you were talking about earlier. I notice my time is almost up. I would ask you to consider that Judge Wake made extensive findings of fact in this case did a full analysis and ask you to affirm his decision. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Counsel, Kearns versus United States will be submitted, and we'll take up Osborne versus Astor.
That's kind of a good argument.